Hello, my name's Matthew Horspool, and welcome back to Braillecast, connecting the dots for Braillists everywhere. Coming up this time, the first of a two-part series looking at Braille in the Pacific Islands. Australia and New Zealand are the two most well-known countries in the Pacific region, the area between Australia and Hawaii. The region also includes many other countries, including Fiji and Samoa. Many of these countries are on small, remote islands in the Pacific Ocean. They are difficult and expensive to reach, with total populations often of 100,000 or fewer, and ensuring access to Braille is very difficult. Over the next two episodes of Braillecast, we'll be finding out more about Braille provision in Pacific Island countries. This episode will discuss the challenges they face and the international intervention which is assisting them. And in the next episode, we'll hear from a representative from the Samoan Blind Persons Association about the work they are doing to overcome these challenges. Ben Clare from Australia has had a career delivering blindness education in Pacific Island countries for over 20 years. He's president of the Pacific region of the International Council for Education of People with Visual Impairment, ICEVI, where he also represents South Pacific Educators in Visual Impairment, SPEVI. Prior to this, he spent 2 years in the Solomon Islands, delivering Braille training and establishing a Solomon Islands government blind service through the Australian Volunteer Program. His first visit to the Pacific Islands in 2004 was to deliver screen reader training at a school in Papua New Guinea through a partnership with the School for the Blind in Sydney. He set off with just a couple of laptops and demo versions of JAWS. I caught up with Ben during the annual conference of the Roundtable on Information Access for People with Print Disabilities, and I started by asking him to describe that first experience.
We had a very large number of students and teachers in my class, and of course I'd never been to Papua New Guinea before. Didn't know a lot about it, wasn't sure how it'd all go, but the enthusiasm and the uptake from these people, the dedication, was incredible. So within sort of 4 days, they were operating these computers on their own and like turning them on and opening, you know, Microsoft Word and all those sorts of things. The only very annoying thing was that we had to reboot the computers every 40 minutes. The centre had an existing Braille production facility, so there was some relatively skilled Braille readers and producers there, but at that stage it was just the computer component that was missing with screen readers. After that point, I was asked to go to the Solomon Islands for 2 years, so we'd go out to very local, very remote communities and work directly with blind people and their families. And a lot of them were not children. Some of them were, but a lot of them were adults, and they'd never been to school or they'd never been out of their village. The first trip I ever did, there was a lady who wanted to learn how to do Braille, and she wanted to learn how to cook, and her family just never thought that those things were possible. And she lived in a very remote village in the Guadalcanal province of Solomon Islands. And every week we would go there. The first week I got there, she was literally rocking on the floor. She was rocking backwards and forwards and not doing anything. But by the time that we'd finished working with her, she was cooking dinner for people in the village, and she had her Braille recipes, and it was so rewarding that you know, and the insatiable sort of learning, you know, wanting to learn, people wanting to learn. And the other thing that I learned from that experience and ones that sort of followed that was that there was, and I've never seen any real resistance to people with disability going to school or anything like that. It's just that the families don't know what options are available. So once they found out and they knew that it was possible to educate their children, they were very, very open to it and very excited, and sometimes they felt quite ashamed that they'd kept them away from school. most of the time no one gets diagnosed. So there were blind people I knew. Some of them had been sighted and they literally woke up blind and no one knew why. It was just, oh, well, you're blind, so get on with it.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was no Braille. There was no formal education. There's ad hoc services in some Pacific Island countries that are definitely making a difference. But it's very reliant on private donors and foreign government agencies to keep these sorts of things going. So the main sort of, I guess, anchor point for disability in the Pacific is an organisation called the Pacific Disability Forum, which is based in Fiji and has member OPDs, organisations of people with disability, from all over the Pacific.
You were talking about teaching computers back in 2004.
Yes.
And, back in 2004... I mean, I don't know that many people in England had the internet. I mean, it existed and many people did, but many people didn't. And I just trying to imagine, you know, the internet out in Pacific countries. And then what about like electricity supplies, and how safe was that, and how regular was that? And all of those factors surely must have contributed.
They were always challenges. So whenever the power was on, which wasn't very often, you would hurriedly plug in every computer that was available and charge it up. The internet for the first couple of years that I did this sort of work was non-existent. It wasn't there. When the power went out, we would literally have like quizzes around the room. So I'd ask, you know, what's the keystroke for this and what's the key combination for that? And we would practice that way while we waited for the power to come back on.
Okay.
And when it did, we'd all go, quick, back to your workstations. So it was, you know, if you didn't have the patience of, you know, you would, you know, be screaming. But it became fun, and you just adapt to the different environment. You try to utilize local conditions and local equipment as much as possible. There isn't much local equipment, but it's amazing how you can improvise and come up with different methods of doing things, and of course in the Pacific they're not as connected to the clock as we are. So if something runs late or whatever, it doesn't matter as much as it does sort of in the Western world. We don't get all upset if we start at 20 past 9 instead of 9 o'clock, for example, because it takes a lot of effort to get people to even come to a training course. You've got to have money for bus fares, if buses are available. You've got to, often people will come with a guide, so it might be a parent or a friend or someone else in the village they've managed to grab onto. You've got to have food. That's the first thing I'll always say. If you're going to have an event, got to have the food, got to have lots and lots of food. So it actually can cost a lot of money, but I see it as an investment. It's an investment in the future of people who have immense talent and skills to offer. And I always argue whenever I'm talking to government ministries and whatever that if these people are working, then they're paying taxes. So we should be pushing them towards that so that they can pay taxes and look after their families and not be the burden that everyone seems to think that they are. And they see education too as a way out of poverty. I mean, and as it is for a lot of people. And certainly in the 20 years since I've been in the Pacific, and there are, of course, others working in this area too, we have seen students with vision impairment go off to uni, get jobs. You know, some of them have studied abroad. We've had people studying in Japan and, you know, Australia and the UK. You know, and these are totally blind people who've come from incredibly remote places, but they've been able to pick up the skills quite quickly, adapt and catch up. I mean, it's not uncommon to have, say, 12-year-olds in sort of grade one, which would normally be for 6-year-olds. Teenagers in with kindergarten students, you know, because they've just never been to school. And then it's incredible how quickly some of them catch up. A lot of the work I do, I always work with local people so that they actually own whatever project it is they're doing. It's not me. I might be an advisor, I might get it going, but then things have to continue when I'm not there. So you have to make sure you've got sufficient people trained up. And one of the things I was saying the other day during the Australian Braille Authority meeting was that one thing they have to do here in Western Australia is make sure that they're not just training a couple of people when they get people over to work on them bosses and things. You've got to have as many as you can because people drop out of the system and then you're back to square one. And that happens in the Pacific all the time.
Thinking specifically about Braille, some places more than others, but there's a whole slew of technology that I suppose we in the Western world would take for granted. You've got your laptop, that's fine, it's got a JAWS or MBDA. You probably have a Braille display, you might have a note taker, you know, or something. There's so many ways of accessing Braille. You might have an embosser. And some of these challenges presumably would prevent some of this technology from working terribly well out in the Pacific region.
They do. And the difficulties range from appropriate storage of items, the weather is a factor. It's very humid and wet, so equipment deteriorates very quickly. There's all that right through to a lot of iPhones, even with free apps that you download, you usually have to set up an Apple ID, and it's very hard to set that up without a credit card number. So, you know, just things like that, you know, a lot of people don't have credit cards in the islands. The currency that they use is very weak against the Australian dollar, US dollar, euro, all those. It's very, you know, it's about 3-1, 4-1, maybe even higher. We've had embossers actually brailing, and then the power might go out in the middle of a session. And that's not unheard of. You usually can go back and wipe it and start again. But when the power comes back on, that's, you know, unless, because sometimes they may forget to switch it off, or they don't know if it's switched off, you then have, you know, this massive surge through it, and it instantly renders the whole machine unusable unless you can get it back to somewhere like Australia. And because we all know how heavy just about all the embossers on the market really are. Interestingly, though, embossers are quite plentiful in the region. It's the one thing that when centres for the blind or schools for the blind or associations of the blind in the region, when they get an opportunity to get some funding, that's usually the first thing that they'll ask for is an embosser. Probably under the mistaken belief that all you do is just plug it in and then plug the computer in and you've got an instant Braille copy of something. I mean, we all know that it doesn't really work like that. But the one thing that's good about it, though, and that's pleasing, is that they do see the relevance of Braille, the continued relevance of Braille, amidst many people who tell them it's too expensive to produce. Education departments want the islands to get rid of Braille, but because they don't want to fund it. No one wants to fund, you know, the production of Braille or Braille machines. And why don't we just go straight to computers, because we can eliminate an expense. But I have to say they're very good advocates for continued Braille use in the islands. And despite all those challenges that you come up with that I've encountered over the years, it hasn't actually stopped Braille from getting through. The other big thing that's a big issue with any form of technology, whether it is low tech or high tech, is the repair of the item, and that's a problem everywhere, I think, and it's expensive to get note takers and things repaired. I shy away from them mainly for that reason that, you know, if you give someone a laptop, at least someone local might be able to fix it if something goes wrong. And especially now with all this NVDA and Narrator and all that built in. Whereas if I said, oh, look, we, you know, I've got a Monarch. Could you have a look at that? They would just, you know, like they would go, oh, my God, there's no way. And, you know, it just costs too much to get them sent back to Australia. They don't always get returned because they can't afford to pay the postage for it to go back. And one example was there was a high school student who had a donated Braille Note Apex, and it was going okay, but it needed servicing. So I said, "Oh well, I'll take it back to Australia with me, and we'll see what we can do." And the when I tried to get it repaired here, they just said to me, "Oh, throw that in the bin. We're not servicing them anymore. They're old hat. We don't even touch them. The best thing you can do is throw it in the bin and get something new." But my goodness, you know, like that's not really an option for, you know, someone in Fiji. And of course, but that's what I had to actually do was throw it out because we couldn't get it repaired anywhere. And it's not always the money that's the barrier, although obviously it is a huge barrier when it comes to high prices. But you know, things were lower priced but were usable, people would quite happily fundraise for items that they needed. It's not that they want everything for nothing. It's just that, you know, you couldn't expect someone to pay $10,000 for something when and even to get funding for such an item when, you know, you could, you know, buy a couple of hundred 10-kilo bags of rice, you know, to feed a village. You've got to think of it like in those terms, especially when it comes down to fighting for funds, you know.
I'll talk more about Braille in just a second because there are some fascinating questions about it.
Yeah.
Before I do, you were talking about some of those challenges and how machines would just fry in a power surge and all of those sorts of things.
Yes.
I feel and throwing out old Braille displays and things like that, I feel like there's perhaps a conversation that needs to be had with the industry. Because it's something that we just don't think about. I mean, I don't think about it. The number of times that I've said to someone, oh, yeah, Braille Note Apex, yeah, good luck with that. Yeah, might as well just get a Brilliant or something. And you just say it without even thinking about it.
Yes.
Have you managed to have any sort of constructive dialogue with any part of the industry about this?
Yes, and I think probably the thing that's probably come closest to a possible solution to this has sort of been through Orbit Research with their Braille Orbit readers that they released about 5 years ago. I wouldn't say that solved the issue, but what it did do, at least initially, was promote Braille displays in places where Braille displays were not seen before. So when they were first introduced, I wouldn't say the prices were affordable for the islands, but it was much easier to get money for donations to get them. So I was able to get a couple of those into the islands, and they were fascinating for people that were using them. We did find, though, that there were issues around the batteries not charging up and, you know, probably again due to power issues and so forth. So they didn't last as long as I would have liked, but maybe they've improved now, and it's something I will continue to go through. I do speak to the industry a lot, but they often say things like, it's a small market that we're operating in, we don't have the buying power. Well, we actually need the money that we get from these high prices to innovate in the first place. But it's people are starting to take notice. I know the Australian government recently committed money in its most recent federal budget to the purchase and delivery of assistive technology, which includes, you know, Braille and computers and hearing aids, wheelchairs, all that sort of thing. The thing that's hard to explain to donors is that everything is consumable. I mean, you can't share a cane with someone. Braille is maybe a little bit more, Computers, though, and other items, excuse me, it's difficult. You know, they need to be for personal use a lot of the time. So that means once you've given it to someone, it's out of the market. You know, it's no longer available for other people. And that's especially the case with computers. If it's a school environment, we tend to share them during the day. But if it's for university students and that, we can't do it. They need those computers for their own individual study.
Yeah.
Because most of the computer labs either don't have accessible computers or the ones that do. And there are, the University of the South Pacific is actually has an accessibility centre that does have, you know, computers with NVDA and so forth. But there's actually quite a queue for them to use them because, of course, it's for anyone with disability, with any disability. So you do have people that aren't blind using those same computers. But we try and investigate local manufacturer of things. That has its challenges too because you've got to get the parts in to manufacture things. White canes, we've had a bit of success. In some of the smaller island countries, we use bamboo to make white canes. They paint them white and they have, you know, like reflectors and all that sort of thing on them. And they don't fold up or anything like that, but they're pretty impressive. And you see some people in smaller countries like Kiribati and that using those. But everyone, of course, wants standard canes.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people are probably walking around with the wrong size because they just get whatever.
That's right. There's no understanding of those sorts of challenges, is there?
No, yeah. No, there isn't. So it's really, it's difficult, you know, to provide those sorts of things. Yeah.
What about the infrastructure? You were talking about needing to send equipment away for repair. And I mean, this is a problem even in the developed world. But yes. I mean, I would think nothing about if I needed to send something away. I'd say, well, are you going to arrange a pickup? Are you going to give me a label for that? Because I can't print it off and do whatever. And I mean, I'm guessing that's a completely different situation out there.
Totally different situation. To send an item like that overseas, you'd have to pay a courier company probably a lot of money. And there's only one or two that operate into the Pacific. It would take approximately 6 weeks probably to get the item from the islands to, say, Australia or New Zealand. That's if someone's not taking it. Then it gets repaired and then they would have to send it back another 6 weeks. But then, of course, the value, because you've got to put a value on the sticker, on the box where it goes back in. If it's above a certain amount of money, then you've got to pay duty, import duty.
Mm-hmm.
At the island end. And, of course, they don't have the money to pay the import duty. It could be thousands of dollars. So it just sits on the wharf. So unless you can cover all the costs associated with, and of course the courier company can't tell you what all those costs are because they don't know what the customs duty is going to be, you know, so it's hard to budget. You can't sort of go ring, say, you know, one of the big courier firms and say, look, okay, I want a quote on how much it's going to be, shipping there back. They can only tell you what their parts are going to cost, not what the import duties are going to be. What often happens is that if someone is going to Australia, they will be asked to take an item with them. And these are sometimes people that aren't even known. So that you might go out to the airport and you'll see that there's a Qantas flight going to Sydney or something. And you might approach someone, usually someone that's from the same country. So it might be a Fijian or a Samoan who's going to visit family in Australia or something. And you might say, look, can you take this for me to Australia and drop it off or arrange, and then someone will arrange to pick it up in Sydney at Sydney Airport or Brisbane Airport or whatever. And then it's done in reverse. So they'll try and, you know, through the grapevine, find out whether there's a relative or a friend or someone in Australia who can go back to the airport and find someone to bring it back. It's totally inefficient, but, you know, and of course it's dangerous too, because people ask you, do you know what's in that bag? And most of the people don't know what's in those bags. But sometimes it's the only way to get stuff in and out. And, you know, a lot of the Australian and New Zealand distributors of assistive technology actually claim that they do support the Pacific. They say, we are the distributors for the Pacific region. But they don't really know how to do it properly. They don't have any sort of arrangements in place for delivery or whatever of those items. It's something that perhaps we could work on with say, Quantum and Humanware and whatever, because they do claim that the Pacific is their territory for distribution and servicing of those items. So that could be an option to talk to them more about that.
And you've said that you've trained individuals in the use of equipment. You were also talking about how you tried to get Boston to come over to fit, to help to train locals in how to fix Perkins Brailers, and that was prohibitively expensive.
But it was.
That sounds like an initiative that you're trying to do is actually train the locals as to repair their own equipment.
That's right. So if the theory is that if you can do it locally, then you shouldn't have to send something internationally to get repaired. We did try to get people from Boston to come to the Pacific. We were going to have a bring people from every Pacific country. We'd all gather in one place and the Perkins trainers would run courses. It didn't eventuate due to the cost of bringing people over. So I did it myself. And that's when I realised how many Brailers actually exist in these countries, because they just kept coming out of the woodwork. I thought there'd only be a couple we would be fixing, but there are Perkins Brailers all over the islands that have been donated by, you know, just people who've got them in their cupboards in Australia or New Zealand or somewhere, and they've just handed them over or donated them. We've got Brailers in the islands from the 60s, you know, really old machines that have, you know, and they've even got their like original stickers on them from the 60s or whatever. So they're quite collector's items, some of them. And they're like, oh, this Brailer hasn't worked for years. You know, we managed to fix all of them. And we had a lot of blind people in our classes too. So initially we would start it working in groups of two. So the blind person would be paired off with someone who was sighted so they could see how the screwdrivers worked and how you pulled it all apart. But by the end, the blind people were doing it on their own, replacing keys. And so I got the initial, so each person who attended those trainings, so there was one in Papua New Guinea and then one in Fiji, and I'm hoping to do more. Each person got their own pack with all the tools they needed and all the spare parts to service about 5 Brailers per pack. Then the trick was, as part of their training, they had to work out, they had to visit local hardware stores to see if they could find local, like screws and that would work just as well as the ones that came from Boston. So not everything could be got locally, but most of the items we could get, certainly the oils and the screws and the... So that meant too they didn't have to keep writing to Boston to get donations of these spare part kits. So that was really successful, and we need to do a lot more of them. It's just, again, a question of money and when I can get over. But they were really successful. And we also had a deal with Index at one stage, who went to 3 Pacific Island countries and did some work on maintenance of embossers, because Index seemed to be the embosser of choice in the Pacific, probably because Index is well serviced in Australia, but they seem to be the ones that go to the islands a lot. And it could be because of the Everest with the single sheets of paper, because again, they can be bought locally, those papers. They're not called Braille paper, of course, but you can buy them from office supply stores. I don't know what they call them, but they come in these plastic packets. And that, again, saves us from having to get Braille paper from Australia and New Zealand. You know, that can go through an embosser or through a Perkins with no problem at all. It's slightly smaller than the paper that we have, and it's not bleached, so it's quite rough to feel, but the Braille comes out just fine. It's all these little things you learn along the way that make things possible. Because if you don't investigate options, it stops. Things just stop where they were. You know, like before you go, for example, if I'm doing a training program, I download everything off the net before I go, including YouTube videos and things. I download all that and put them all onto flash drives and give them all flash drives as part of their training. No good relying on the internet, because you might be presenting a YouTube and that just stops, you know, in the middle. And you road test everything before you leave. You test the software you're using, you test everything to make sure that when you get there and start training, you're not going to come up with some horrible geographic problem or a license that won't work or an internet that won't connect. So it's really, you just rehearse it all before you go and then put it all into action when you get there. Because it's great, but there's a high expectation, you know, and it can be quite nerve-wracking. A session will start with, you know, a prayer, and then everyone then looks at you. The whole room goes quiet. So it's like, right, over to you, right? So you've got to know exactly where you're going to start and what's going to be engaging. And of course, for some countries, you've got to have translators, you know, into their local language. So that can really slow the rhythm of a training session down.
And I'm glad you brought up language, because that's, I think, the one barrier that we haven't really talked about. And it really, it gets to the heart of so many things. But for this podcast, it really gets to the heart of Braille. We, in our, you know, Western bubble, have been complaining about Unified English Braille or otherwise about Unified English Braille, but that's been a thing. We've had a perfectly good, you know, many ways, perfectly good English Braille system.
Yes.
And we've decided that we're going to improve it by having UEB. Now, I mean, yeah. I think it probably is an improvement. I think most people would grudgingly agree with that.
Yes.
But nonetheless, we're able to talk at that level. We've got a code and we want to make another code.
Yes.
Presumably, out in the Pacific region, that's caused huge amounts of upheaval in and of itself.
Oh, it has. And, you know, it's so funny. The first thing they always say to me is, why don't you Westerners just leave it alone? You know, like, we just learned this, the code, and now you're throwing new things at us. There is that. We have a bit of a laugh about that. But what... UEB is used across the English-speaking Pacific, at least. And when I say the English-speaking Pacific, all these countries, English isn't the first language. It's just that they were former British colonies and they do conduct business in English. So they do, you know, English is taught in school and whatever, but it's not their mother language, and they certainly don't speak it amongst their friends and all that sort of stuff. So there is that difficulty also. So UEB, I think, what was happening in the islands and what's still happening, and hopefully UEB will address this and really stick to this unified as part of the word, because it's dependent on who taught you Braille and how long ago as to what code you're sort of using. So I've seen people who are quite proficient at Braille, but they're using a very outdated Braille code that hasn't been around for years. And it's because there may have been someone from England or something in the 60s or 70s who came over to the islands, might have even been a missionary or someone, taught Braille the way they knew it, you know, and then, of course, that's then been passed down with relative, you know, with changes in accuracy and interpretation. So what's sort of happening is a lot of people know different types of Braille. So some countries were taught by the Americans, some were taught by the British, some were taught by Australia, you know, and you can actually see the difference, you know, when you see these adult Braille readers, these Braille readers and writers doing Braille, you can go, oh, yep, they were taught the British way, yep, there's no capitals in there. So we have a bit of a laugh about that. So what we're now trying to do, and with UEB, is to have the one standard which of course is what UEB strives to do, is to just have that one standard that everyone is learning. And there isn't this sort of confusion about what system to use. They seem quite open to that. And the UEB online course that's around has started to have an impact. So we're starting to get teachers that are doing that online course and are now starting to teach kids and students UEB, which is good. It's really good. Mathematics is another problem that's just starting to be tackled now. What was happening in the islands was a lot of people were just skipping maths altogether because the teachers didn't know how to do it, so the students never learned. Mm-hmm. Tactile graphics is the same. So because they're so expensive and cumbersome to produce, they were just left out of exams and things. But what was happening was, and this is the tragedy of it, is the examiners, if these kids were sitting national exams, the examiners were not notified that these kids were skipping all the questions with tactile graphics. And anyone who knows what a sort of a department set exam is like, it's loaded with tactile graphics, you know.
Oh, gosh,
they're everywhere, right? So they were getting big fat zeros on their papers. Mm. You know, really smart people getting zeros because it wasn't filtering through to the examiners that these kids couldn't read tactile graphics and they weren't even being produced. Not even described. There was not even alternate text or descriptions on a lot of these. So this is the challenge now that we're looking at you know, is getting these minimum standards for teachers so that we know that they're teaching the kids the right thing. And, you know, that includes mathematics and tactile graphics. It isn't easy. It's really difficult to bring it all together, but it's starting to happen and there's a lot of people wanting it to happen. Local languages are generally not written in Braille. Where it happens, they're using the English sort of alphabet and letters, but it's all just grade one Braille. But there is some interest in developing language-specific Braille codes for the Pacific countries, which is very exciting, and I hope that they can do it. There's a bit of argument, of course, because of those people who've learned, you know, such old-fashioned Braille over the years as to what would be a standard. But it's nice these discussions are happening now. It's great.
This just has been a really fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate you sort of taking the time to have it. We should probably wrap this up fairly soon, but is there anything else you wanted to say while you've got the opportunity to say it?
Yeah, look, apart from a great big thank you for allowing me to be on the podcast, it's wonderful. It's a big honour for me. But I think it's great what's starting to happen now. You know, sort of just going back to my previous point just now about, you know, I'm just so thrilled that Braille is continuing to be relevant and that people in developing countries are resisting this cheaper option that suits sighted people. I think that's great that, you know, we shouldn't be necessarily worrying about money when we're educating people. Wasting money, yes, we should worry about that. But this isn't a waste of money. This is something that's really, you know, helping people to be educated. It's an investment. Braille assists with all those other things, with all the other technologies that we work on later. It's not something that's a rival to it. And that's where, that's what I really believe, that Braille is an assistant throughout people's lives, even if they're not using it in workplaces later on. The fact they've got that knowledge is just, yeah, it's so required. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Well, Ben, Claire, thank you very much for appearing on Braillecast. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Braillecast, the official podcast of the Braillists Foundation. You can find more Braille-related content by subscribing to Braillecast, all one word, in your podcast client of choice, or listening to Braillecast, connecting the dots for Braillists everywhere on your smart speaker. You can also find past episodes on our website at braillecast.com. If you have comments on the podcast or suggestions of topics or guests for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. Please email help@braillists.org. You can also find the Braillists on Twitter, @Braillists, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Braillists Foundation. Finally, if you like what you've heard, spread the word. New listeners are always welcome, so if you know other people who are interested in Braille, please tell them where to find us. In the meantime, on behalf of everyone at the Braillists, thanks for listening and bye for now. The costs of producing this episode were defrayed by a resilience grant from the Social Impact Fund of the Vision Foundation and Fight for Sight. For more information, visit visionfoundation.org.uk.